The Guardian.
This is The Guardian at the Edinburgh International Book Festival 2013 with Claire Armitstead.
Welcome to day four of our Edinburgh Books podcasts. Today, we're starting a two-day investigation of the human brain, looking at what neuroscience can and can't tell us about our emotions with two science writers from the cutting edge. Giovanni Frazzetto's How We Feel takes an interdisciplinary approach. This molecular biologist is as much at home with Wagner and Wittgenstein as he is with the intricacies of brain scanning. Kathleen Taylor looks at the moral and ethical issues arising from a young science, which, she argues, is about to become the big daddy of them all, more transformative and revolutionary than quantum physics. Kathleen, let's start with the title of your book. Why have you called it The Brain Supremacy?
I guess what I'm talking about is the idea that neuroscience is coming to play a more and more important role in our lives, in our society, in our culture. We're already seeing that with the sort of plethora of adverts with brain imaging scans on and all sorts of things. But I think it's a much deeper role than that. And the reason is that paying more attention to neuroscience and having that have a bigger cultural place in our lives is going to mean that we have to rethink our ethics in quite a serious way. So the transformation that neuroscience is going to bring is a scientific transformation, but it's also, if you like, a moral transformation. And that's what I mean by the brain supremacy, this era that is going to come when neuroscience is going to start being more and more important to us.
So you point out that there are lots of different areas of interest. So there's medical, there's business, and somehow we've got to bring all these together in this area. And I was particularly shocked by your anecdote about the intelligence agencies being interested in neurological research.
Well, this is the problem, because neuroscience derives ultimately from medicine. And so that part of it is governed by the medical ethics, you know, Hippocratic oath, first do no harm and all that sort of stuff. And that is a very patient-centred, it puts the person centrally. So in that sense, neuroscience is very unlike other sciences because they don't deal with persons, they deal with objects, they deal with things in the universe. But neuroscience is also very desirable to a lot of interests who have very different ethics. So, for example, the military ethic is quite different from the medical ethic, which is again different from the corporate ethic. That is a big set of conflicts that we have to kind of work out how to deal with.
Giovanni, your book goes into lots of other disciplines. You're a molecular biologist by training, but you're not afraid to quote Wittgenstein or indeed Schubert.
It is a very interdisciplinary journey through emotions. I was trained as a molecular biologist, but already at the postdoctoral level, I hang in departments of sociology and humanities to try and complement my knowledge with what, how people understood science in different fields. And emotions need to be regarded through all these different lenses in order to make full sense of them. So I take a very personal journey through emotions. I talk about anger, guilt, fear, sadness, empathy, and joy. And I try and tell when science did help me understand them, but when I also needed help from other disciplines or things such as a poem, a play, or a passage from a philosophical volume.
And analogy plays a really important part for both of you, and I'm really interested in this because, for example, I think you use, Giovanni, the analogy of the knowability of a city lighting up at night.
I compare the view of a brain scan, the blob on a brain scan, this orange reddish blob against a greyish black background of a brain scan, to being up on top of the London Eye and having a 360-degree view on the city of London at night and seeing all those flickering lights. We have an approximate view of what is going on, who's up and what areas of London are busy. So we can see what's happening in Maida Vale or what's happening in Golders Green or Covent Garden. But in fact, that view doesn't tell us who the light is on for and what is the motivation behind keeping it up. And so I use this analogy to describe how the methods of, you know, how the vision of the brain scan is still an approximate view on the brain.
Now, another point you make, which seems to be relevant to both books, is you make the distinction between feelings and emotion. And that seems to be fairly central.
It is a central difference because we understand emotions as bodily states, things that happen to us and happen in our bodies, reactions to the environment, to things people say, things we see, things that happen to us. Whereas feeling is the emotions which has been made conscious. So it is a secondary experience of the emotions. The famous psychologist William James first talked about this already at the end of the 19th century when he said that our body first reacts to seeing a bear in the woods and then we become afraid of it and we run away. This is a central notion in the field of emotions because we are bodies that experience life.
Kathleen, is this a distinction that you recognise?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, emotion neuroscience is still very young, but one of the things that's really come out of it is how much this importance of the body has come to the fore. I mean, there was a time back in neuroscience where even to talk about consciousness was a little bit, you know, not quite done, and to talk about emotions was really not quite done too. But since we've had neuroimaging, like fMRI, we've been able to really crack open the black box of the brain and start looking inside, then it's become much more okay in rigorous scientific circles to talk about emotions. And what's really emerged from that is just how interconnected they are with the body. You know, how your heart rate changes what you're feeling, how you can actually, I mean, there have been famous experiments that have presented people with, there's a famous psychology experiment that gave people a shot of adrenaline and then gave them different contexts, and they interpreted either as excitement or fear or something, you know, depending on how they were cued to do it. And yet they're having the same physical experience. So what you're getting is you've got a physical thing, you've got a bodily response to it, and then you've got the whole context that piles in, and that's what determines which emotion you feel, which feeling you get, which conscious experience you have. So it's a really complicated picture, but also a really interesting one.
Giovanni, what is to say that, for example, grief is an emotion? Now, grief has recently been reclassified by a very important diagnostic manual, the name of which I can never get right, as an abnormality if it goes on for more than 2 weeks, even after a bereavement.
It's a very scary decision. Grief, which is a normal reaction to loss, to the loss of somebody, has now been classified as a mental illness. This just happened when the new edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual was released. Before that, sadness in response to the loss of somebody was considered as an accepted reaction, but now this distinction is no longer made, so anyone who grieves for longer than 2 weeks can earn a diagnosis of major depression, and that also means that they can be treated with pills and medications.
Kathleen, do I detect big pharma or insurance companies getting in on the act?
It is an ethical worry. I mean, I would say, being a neuroscientist, go back to the brain. You know, there is nothing in the brain that says, okay, after 2 weeks, you must make this major depression rather than just normal grief. That's a purely social, cultural decision that has been made. Now, the brain itself is not, you know, this is something we impose on the brain. And an awful lot of neuroscience is precisely that. It's looking at the brain, trying to interpret it, and then other people taking that interpretation and in some cases hyping it beyond all reason. Now, what the motives are for this particular piece of social decision making that says, right, grief after this barrier will be abnormal. I mean, the motives could be many and various, but that's what it is. It's a social decision. We will define grief as abnormal if it lasts for this long. That's nothing to do with the brain. That's just a social thing.
Grief is an emotion that we've experienced, you know, throughout humanity, and has been called in many different ways. It's got its origins in melancholy and sadness. It was understood in different terms. We now understand it in molecular terms, but there were all sorts of theories in ancient Greece, for instance, that described grief, such as the humoral theory.
What about pleasure? Now, you have an example of scientific dating, scientifically calculated compatibility between potential partners. Do we believe in that?
There's been a tendency to construct websites, that online dating websites based on science, and to match people on the basis of four molecules, neurotransmitters or hormones, estrogen, testosterone, serotonin or dopamine. I personally believe that it's a huge leap to try and match people on the basis of what kind of neurotransmitters are traveling in their brains, because we cannot really measure that. And I think the on top of that, he kind of disenchants romance and the way we may find a partner in a more traditional, conventional way by meeting people in all sorts of places.
Your reaction, Kathleen, was more robust to that suggestion, wasn't it?
Oh, Lord. I mean, I suppose it would be facile of me to say that they should stop worrying so much about dating and go out and read a good book instead, preferably one about neuroscience. But, yeah, I mean, you know, this is hideously premature, and we're talking about four neurotransmitters. Out of all the complexity of the brain, I think we've got a long way to go before we can scientifically match people for, like, something as complicated as love.
But Giovanni, you got yourself analysed, didn't you, what sort of person you were and what sort of person you'd be compatible with.
I took the test and I turned out to be a negotiator explorer, which means I'm supposed to have a lot of dopamine and estrogen inside myself. But in my book, How We Feel, in the last chapter on love, I talk a lot about this, and I'm very much against the use of such websites.
But there's a physiological thing. It involves the length of your relative lengths of your fingers as well.
Yes, it depends on the exposure to testosterone you had when you were a fetus in the placenta. So if you were exposed to a lot of testosterone, the ring finger in your right hand would be longer than your index finger. And those will also determine the amount of testosterone in your adult life.
This is quite extraordinary, isn't it, Kathleen?
Yes, I mean, there is slightly more evidence for the role of testosterone prenatally. So there's been a lot of work done on its effects in the brain. It is one of the major sex hormones, so you would expect it to have some effect. And that has ranged into many different fields of neuroscience, from neuroeconomics through to looking at learning disorders, which tend to be gender biased. So all that sort of stuff. There's a lot of work going on there, but you know, it's a huge step from saying, well, testosterone may have had this effect in the womb, to therefore this kind of person will be compatible with you on a dating site. I mean, that's just a big leap.
Two final questions. One is about left hand versus right hand brain, which I thought had been discredited. I thought that was woo-woo stuff, but actually, Giovanni, you say it has been demonstrated that one side of the brain is more positive than the other.
Yes, it seems that when it comes to emotion, the brains take sides. I talk about it in my chapter on joy and pleasure. The first discovery was made by a neurologist who observed patients with big lesions in either the left or right side of the brain. And those with the lesion in the right hand side of the brain, the right side of the brain underlines negative emotions, whereas the left side of the brain underlines positive emotions. This goes back to the first asymmetry discovered in the brain with regard to language. The left side of the brain was responsible for determining language processing. Later on, other experiments were done, and so they figure out that, you know, people are very different in the way they experience emotions, whether their left or right inside of the brain is more active in a way. So Richard Davidson, for instance, looked at how, by electroencephalography, looked at how there were basal states, default states, in which parts of the brain were more active. And people who had more activity in the right hand side of the brain were more prone to negative emotions, for instance. And he looked at differences across individuals.
Kathleen, we have to be a bit careful of these sort of distinctions, don't we? Because we make very basic assumptions.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, the first question you ask about any science like that is, has it been thoroughly replicated? And exactly what are we talking about here? So you cannot now go out from that and say, right, okay, everybody is either a left brain emotion or a right brain person. And if you're right brain, you're going to be prone to depression. And if you're left brain, you're going to be like sunny as heck. I mean, it doesn't work like that. It's much more complicated than that, because a whole lot of factors are coming into play as well. So yes, you can say that there seems to be some kind of asymmetry in activity, but what that actually means in terms of, well, you know, how you should change your lifestyle is another question.
Now, the final question I thought was absolutely fascinating, and since we're in Edinburgh and since this is a books podcast, you have this story about fictional characters and non-fictional characters being stored in different bits of the brain and meaning according to what they mean. So you're saying that somebody in Scotland who is thinking about the Loch Ness monster will store it in a different place to somebody in London like me who's talking about the Loch Ness monster.
Well, since childhood we are exposed to stories and to imaginary realities, and so we learn what to distinguish what is real and what is not. An experiment conducted in Germany revealed that different parts of the brain are active when we are exposed to real things versus to imaginary things. And they asked people to think about a character, Peter, who either talked to George Bush or Cinderella. And of course, George Bush is a real person that you may have dinner with, but you cannot have dinner with Cinderella, or at least not for real. And when the subjects were exposed to Cinderella, a particular part of the brain, the frontal gyrus, was activated, which has got which processes language and metaphor. But what are you referring to, and why the Loch Ness would be something real to a Scottish person, perhaps, is because they concluded that it's not really what is real or what is not, but what is relevant to you, what is relevant to the reservoir of knowledge that you have. So you may well relate to George Bush because he's a human being, and you know exactly, you know, how his life works, but you have a hard time to frame Cinderella or Harry Potter, for that matter, because they don't exactly belong to humanity.
Kathleen, this raises a really interesting possibility that you, as science popularizers, if I can say that, or you're explaining it, you're using one part of your brain to explain the work that another part of your brain is doing.
Well, when you think about it, I mean, it makes a lot of sense, because there is no independent route for knowledge. I mean, how else is it going to get into your brain except via the usual channels of eyes and ears and all the rest of it? And this is the problem that people have with brainwashing. When somebody comes out of a cult, they can really struggle to communicate with somebody because their realities have been different. And if you control what goes into the brain, you control what the thoughts are inside the brain. And if you control that, you can control what is real to people. What they experience is real to them. What happens to them is real to them. And so you can shift how real something seems by really quite simple manipulations. And so, you know, there's no kind of, like, we're not all grounded. There's no kind of extra route that tells us, oh, actually, this is real and this is fake. What we're doing is we're looking at our own experience, our own personal experience, those people around us, and we take what is real from them. So, you know, if you lived with Cinderella for years as if she was a real person, or if you had a favourite teddy bear called Cinderella, that would be real to you, and it would be represented in the real part of the brain, quote unquote.
You might perish the thought to not believe that George Bush is a credible character. So where does all this discussion leave psychiatry?
Psychiatry will not disappear. However, there's a huge effort in trying to point markers, biological markers, that can give a definite diagnosis for a mental illness. Psychiatrists and neuroscientists are collaborating to find those markers for all kinds of illnesses. But it's a long way to go, because psychiatric disorders are such heterogeneous and complex conditions, and so just one biomarker will not be sufficient. There's a multiplicity of factors that are involved in determining the illness. So it's a long way to go, I believe.
Will psychotherapy be redundant? Will we be able to alter brains so you don't need to have long, expensive talking therapies?
Possibly in the far future, but not anytime soon, not reliably. I mean, psychiatry, I'll say what Giovanni said any more cynically, is torn, because at one end there is the tug to deal with a person-centred medical art of helping individual peoples, each of who is different, to cure themselves or to sort out whatever problems they may have. And on the other end, psychiatry wants and seeks the rigour and the respect that being a proper quote-unquote science brings. And so it's pulled towards neuroscience and the urge for, you know, objectivity, quote-unquote. And that's a conflict, you know, because you can't do both. You can't treat each person as an individual special case and do the kind of group studies, for example, that neuroscience requires. So psychiatry is to that extent, in a bit of a mess.
Giovanni Frazzetto and Kathleen Taylor. In tomorrow's podcast, we'll be looking at the brain and imagination.
The Books Podcast from Guardian.co.uk.